Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Which inventions have fundamentally changed the way humans live? We are keenly aware of the vast advances in digital and communication technology that shape 21st century existence, but some brilliant ideas have become so essential to us that we overlook their stunning impact on politics, economics, interpersonal relationships, even artistic achievement. Author Stephen Johnson decided to trace the influence of landmark technological developments whose effects at first glance might seem rather self-contained. Advances in things like glassmaking, climate control, timekeeping, and water purification. And he discovered some astonishing unintended benefits and consequences. The new book by Stephen Johnson is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. There is a companion television series that airs on KERA Television Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Oh, it's great to be back. I feel like it's not a book tour if I don't show up here.
Well, thank you for that. You write that innovations usually begin life with an attempt to solve a specific problem, but once they get into circulation, some of them end up triggering changes that would have been nearly impossible to predict. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things that is at the center of this book and the show. It's both, I think, intellectually a really interesting part of it and also just fun because it takes you off on all these kind of surprising twists. But basically what happens is, you know, ideas, as you said, people when they're working on some new solution to some problem, some need of human society, the actual solution they come up with is actually very focused on that specific need. But once it gets into circulation, it ends up triggering these strange, you know, kind of after effects that ripple through society in all these unpredictable ways. Actually, one of the examples that's one of my favorite stories in the book is an example of this is the impact of air conditioning on the United States. So, and this is, you know, somewhat relevant for Texas.
77 degrees today. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm here in New York and it's not that warm. So basically, you had once air conditioning was introduced in right around 1950 as a home appliance. You had kind of window units and things like that. It very quickly triggered this mass migration of people, really the largest migration of people in the history of the United States to the warmer parts of the country, to Florida and to Texas and particularly to the desert states where basically nobody lived. I mean, there was like 107 people living in Las Vegas at the turn of the century. And it's been actually one of the fastest growing cities in the country for the last 20 or 30 years. And that's interesting enough in itself. You invent air conditioning to make, you know, the room cooler, and it ends up triggering these changes that are visible from space in human settlement patterns, which is amazing. But that, of course, ends up redrawing the political map of America. So there are all these votes that swing. There's basically a 60-vote swing in the Electoral College from the north to the south, triggered in large part by the invention of air conditioning, which then becomes essential. That kind of Sunbelt coalition becomes essential to Ronald Reagan's successful bid for the White House in 1980. And so there is a very real – I mean, it's not stretching things to say that the invention of air conditioning is a central player in Reagan's successful, presidential campaign of 1980. And we tend to not talk about, you know, home appliances as having that big an impact. I mean, maybe we talk about television with Reagan, but AC is a part of that story as well.
Is that in part because older folks were the ones who initially led the move into, like, the desert Southwest and places like Florida and Texas?
Yeah, exactly. So you get older retirees. And so the population too, there's an unrelated thing that's happening, which is that you have, because of civil rights, you have a migration of African Americans north, and then you have all these older, more conservative retirees that move south, and the Democratic Party and the Republican Party's kind of change their complexion in literal ways and figurative ways. And that new kind of Sunbelt coalition that goes from really Southern California all the way across the South, is more conservative, more Republican than the cohort that had been there before them.
For obvious reasons, a lot of us turn our noses up these days at processed food, but the ability to safely freeze food and store it for a long time had major ramifications and allowed a lot of changes in society that probably Clarence Birdseye wasn't imagining when he first was tinkering with the way to get this done right.
Yeah, well, Birdseye is this really interesting figure. He's in the cold chapter and the cold episode, which just actually aired last week on PBS. And one of the things I love about Birdseye, who, you know, we've kind of seen his name on packages of frozen peas and things like that. Some people don't really know that he was an actual person. He came up with this idea, basically this idea of kind of flash freezing in a kind of an industrial process to create flash frozen food. But the idea itself took at least a decade, depending on how you measure it, to kind of become clear to him. This is what I call the slow hunch, that instead of having that kind of classic eureka moment where this great new discovery pops into his mind and, you know, the world changes. In fact, this was an idea that just grew in a very slow, almost evolutionary kind of way without a clear sense of what he was doing and what he was working on. So at one point, and we actually recreated this in the show, he moves to Labrador with his family. He's got a wife and a very young child, and he's living in Labrador in like 1914 in the winter.
How delightful.
One of the most extreme environments on the face of the earth you can go to, and it's not a really good place to bring a one-year-old child, by the way. And he's just trying to get food, basically. It's, you know, they're living off of moose jerky and, you know, these terrible preserved foods that are sitting around. And so he goes ice fishing with a local Inuit, and it's so cold in the air that when they pull the fish out of the lake, it freezes almost instantly, just, you know, kind of almost before it's landed on the ice, it's frozen. And when they go back 2 days later and kind of thaw it out and then cook it, it tastes much better than any fish he's ever eaten that was thawed out after being frozen. And what I love about Birdseye at this point, if you and I had had this experience, I think, I mean, I don't want to project here, but I think most of us would have the response of saying, well, that was a good fish. I had like a good dinner and now I'm going to go read and go to bed. But Birdseye had this great curiosity about the world. And so he was like, but why was it so tasty? Why did it taste better than any other frozen food I've ever tasted? And so he went and did a series of experiments on other frozen vegetables and fish and meats and things like that, and basically froze them at different speeds. Basically, you know, the lower the temperature, the faster it would freeze. And he found that if he froze something very quickly at a very low temperature, it would taste much better when it thawed out, because it would basically, the freezing process would do less damage to the food. But even then, that idea then sticks in the back of his mind for another 5 years or so before he finally starts to think about how he could build a kind of an assembly line or a kind of a production line to freeze food at this accelerated rate. And it eventually becomes a multi-million dollar idea, and he becomes rich and, you know, makes the world safe for TV dinners and so on. But it came out of this, both this curiosity and this persistence to giving the idea the time it needed to evolve.
Yeah, maybe in the paperback version, you could have an alternate subtitle for this book, and I would call it like Triumph of the Obsessives in the best way, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think about it a lot in terms of kind of education and kids, because the book is pitched at a slightly higher level, but the show is actually a great family show, which ironically we weren't fully aware of while we were making it, but it's a really good show to watch with like an 11-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And I've watched it with my kids who are in that kind of age, and they couldn't care less about the fact that I'm in it. Like, I'm a liability to them. Like, they're like, Dad, that's so embarrassing. Don't do that. Oh, but the kind of the storytelling, I think, you know, and it's shot in kind of a playful way, and it's funny in parts and things like that. And so I think it works nicely as a kind of cross demographic kind of show. But I bring this up because I feel like it's that, you know, it's that property that I think about a lot as a parent, that, you know, that my wife and I would really like to encourage in our kids, that feeling of curiosity about the world and getting really into things, you know, getting really into a problem or a field or something. And it honestly, it doesn't, when you're 11, it really doesn't have to be you know, astrophysics, right? It can just be, I mean, I was really into like dice baseball games when I was a kid. And, you know, I learned a lot about statistics and probability and, you know, just basic math and modeling, you know, complex systems and things like that from like designing my own dice baseball games. And I think my parents thought I was kind of crazy. But that feeling as a child of like, I need to know everything that I can about this particular topic, that's a really great kind of intellectual feeling to have as a young child, because when you turn out to be 30 or 40 or 46, remembering that excitement about something and that passion for something is a really – that's a really valuable tool to have in your toolbox, much more useful than, say, I think, knowing how to do – calculus, you know, because like there's only a very small number of us who need to know how to do calculus, but everybody needs to know how to be curious about the world and engage with the world in that way.
We're about to field many calls from math teachers.
I know,
but,
I just totally alienated the entire like math teaching population of Dallas. I'm sorry.
Well, let's talk about this. We are so reliant on glass today that we literally do not notice it. We see right through it, as it were. Can you talk about the ways that the refinement of glass making technology would change the world?
Yeah, so this is the opening chapter. I think it might be my favorite chapter in the book. I put it right at the beginning because I thought it was pretty cool. So as you said, we don't think of glass as a technology really at all. Although 800, 900 years ago, in some ways, the glassmakers who were in Venice were some of the most advanced technologists in the world. It was in a way the kind of Silicon Valley of the world because of the technologies of glass. And what happened after they basically refined the process so they could make kind of sturdy, fully transparent glass, is that glass found its way into all these kind of components of modern life that we don't really think about. I mean, when I say to people, I mean, the argument really is that glass is the single most important material of the last 1,000 years. And most of the time when I say that to people, they say, what? So like drinking glasses, like windows, what's the big deal? But if you could kind of wave a magic wand and eliminate everything that had been built around glass and silicon dioxide, the material, the kind of underlying, you know, kind of elements involved in glass, if you could take all those things out of modern life, you would eliminate obviously windows and windshields. You would eliminate drinking glasses. But more importantly, you would eliminate spectacles and reading glasses. You would eliminate microscopes and telescopes and all of the scientific, you know, breakthroughs that came out of glass-based microscopes and telescopes over the last 400 to 500 years. You would eliminate all lenses, all cameras, all televisions because of no lenses, all, you know, kind of cinema. Even fiber optics, which is basically the backbone of the internet, is made of glass. Glass fiber is the conduit through which information flows most of the time now with the internet. And so that on some level, the web is kind of woven together with threads of glass, which is just crazy to think about. So we are completely dependent on this substance, which was really not a part of human civilization except, you know, in a few trivial ways up until about 900 years ago.
My guest is author Stephen Johnson. His new book is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. There's a companion television series airing Wednesday nights on KERA television. It starts at 9 on those Wednesdays. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Stephen Johnson. His new book is How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. The companion television series has been airing on KERA television on Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So for people who haven't seen this done in person, it takes a really hot fire, Stephen, to get glass to do what you want it to do. This turns out to have been a blessing and a curse for the glassmakers who congregated in Venice.
Yeah, this is a funny story. So the folks who basically pioneered the glassmaking industry, in a sense, in Venice had come over from Constantinople after the fall of Constantinople, and they arrived in Venice with this relatively well-developed technology for making glass, although they would improve it over the next century or two. But to make glass work, I mean, to kind of release these interesting properties of silicon dioxide, you have to have temperatures of, you know, 1,000 degrees or so. And so they had these furnaces. And they were doing amazing things with glasswork, but they Venice at that point was largely made of wooden structures. And so these glassmakers had shown up and they were like, we really like what you're doing with the glass and it's really good for business here in Venice. However, you keep setting fire to our neighborhoods and we don't like that so much. And so basically they hit upon the kind of the elders in Venice hit upon this solution, which is that the glassmakers were forced to move basically across the marsh to the Isle of Murano, where they still reside to this day. And you could only make glass on Murano. And this had this interesting side effect where it clustered all this innovation into one space. And it created this effect that economists sometimes call information spillover, which is what happens when you crowd people together and ideas, even though there's competition between the various different firms and different families that were making glass, if somebody hit upon a new idea about how to make the process work better or how to make clearer glass or how to make the glass more resilient and so on, that new idea would spread very quickly through the system, through the community. And so it became this innovation hub, basically, as I said before, kind of like a Silicon Valley, 800 years before Silicon Valley. And eventually it became such an important kind of economic asset to Venice that they forbade the glassmakers from leaving Murano under the threat of the death penalty. And it was a bizarre thing because, I mean, on some level it worked. They ended up during that period inventing what was called crystal glass, which was the first really transparent glass that ultimately revolutionized so many different fields because of its transparency. But it was also under the threat of this, you know, death penalty. So it was a bizarre – if you're a mayor today, this is not necessarily the best strategy for encouraging, you know, tech startups to come to your city.
You may never leave.
But it worked back then.
So Gutenberg invented movable type. Movable type democratized demand for literacy, and literacy created demand for really good lenses.
This is the thing that I think is so interesting. So, you know, I've written about Gutenberg multiple times. I think most of us have in our heads this kind of narrative about how Gutenberg changed everything with the invention of movable type and his version of the printing press. And that story almost always involves books get into circulation, ideas are able to be, you know, kind of shared and stored much more efficiently than they were in the age of manuscripts, literacy rates go up, religious scientific revolutions are set in motion by the book. But there's this other story that is not talked about nearly enough, I think, given its impact, which is to say that once literacy rates started to go up and once reading became a practice that is, you know, a sizable number of Europeans were doing for the first time, there was this other funny thing which happened, which was a certain percentage of those readers had a reaction to the book, which is they looked at it and they said, I can't read that. I'm farsighted. I can't make out these little letters on the page. And they realized for the first time that they needed reading glasses and you had spectacles. And basically, you know, up until the introduction of the book, you didn't really have any need to look at small objects unless you were, you know, a seamstress or something. You didn't, you know, that faculty of your vision just wasn't kind of relied upon in any real kind of consistent way. And so the book, in a sense, exposed this, you know, failed vision on a certain number of Europeans, which then created a market for lens makers who suddenly there was big business in manipulating glass into these spectacles and selling them. And that meant that Europe was suddenly kind of populated by all this expertise about making lenses. And as people are wont to do, they started tinkering with these lenses. And before long, they said, hey, you know, if I put two of them together like this, I can make a telescope. And if I do it this way, I can make a microscope. And almost immediately, the telescope, within a couple of years, revolutionized science. Galileo got one of the earliest telescopes and saw the moons of Jupiter, and everything changed. The microscope took about 70 years to really revolutionize kind of medicine and our understanding of the body through the discovery of the cell by Robert Hooke. But, I mean, just think of all the scientific breakthroughs that depended on the extension of our vision that came from the lenses of telescopes and microscopes. And in a weird way, Gutenberg set that in motion by inventing the printing press.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ed in Duncanville. Hi, Ed.
Howdy. This is a wonderful series, and I can't help but think as I was watching, you know, among other things, we learned why one of the Japanese car companies named their car a Murano. But I couldn't help but think, did you think about how to get this stuff into the classroom when you wrote it? And I'm not just science classroom necessarily, but all of this history has fallen out of Texas books. And, boy, I'd love to use these videos in a history class.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much. Yeah, we have thought about it a lot, and there's a big if you go online, there's a big kind of education kind of supplementary material for designed specifically for classrooms and integrating the material into classrooms that's available on the PBS website. Because I think you're right. It does work as a science and kind of technology, a STEM kind of course material, but it's really history, and it's history told from a different angle, right? I mean, we tend to tell history in terms of, you know, large social movements, great heroic figures of history, and big military conflicts. You know, that tends to be the mode that history is taught, particularly on television. And this is trying to take on that these stories from a slightly different angle. It's you know, a lot. First off, the people are a lot of people haven't heard of, these kind of obscure inventors and tinkerers and so on. But it's also looking at the way in which these technologies and these ideas have changed us, right? It's not just like what did we invent, but once we invented it, it ended up having this strange effect on our society. And I feel like, you know, we are shaped by these creations every bit as much as we are shaped by, you know, the kind of great historical battles from 400 years ago, but we don't tell that story enough.
So if your favorite chapter was the one on glass, I'll tell you my favorite was the one
good.
About time.
And
it's
fascinating. That's kind of my second favorite.
Okay, so here's the thing. Okay, people know Galileo and they talk about all the things he did and all the exploration. And then they say, oh, and he also invented the pendulum clock. Like, that's just kind of like a little, like,
yeah,
you know, like he made.
Overachiever.
Right.
What a jerk.
But it's not just that he created this clock. Can you talk a little bit, give us some background on our concept of time and sort of the invention of any understanding of time?
Well, you know, until about, you know, 400 years ago, I guess I would say, it's a little tricky about how you date it. We really lived on a much looser sense of time. And we had, you know, the days had been divided up into hours and minutes and seconds and various other kinds of clocks. But for instance, in the vocabulary of this period, you know, 400, 500 years ago, people would often describe things not in terms of kind of abstract time units, but rather the time it takes to do something. So they would say, I'll see you in the milking of a cow. You know, the milking of a cow, like, is that, I don't know exactly what, you know, 12 minutes is, but I do know how long it takes me to milk a cow. And by the way, I have no idea how long it takes to milk a cow. So if 12 minutes is ridiculously short, I apologize.
Farmers will get in line behind the math teachers.
I know. I've got the calculus teachers and the farmers. So just burning my bridges right left. So they but that was partially because two reasons. Clocks were very inaccurate. They're just, you know, you'd have a town clock, but it could lose like 30 minutes, you know, plus or minus in like a day, you know. So
wow.
You had to reset it every day. They just weren't accurate at all. And the other reason is that people's lives just weren't oriented around this kind of grid of time that we now take for granted. So there wasn't media that was going to start at 9 p.m. and there wasn't the idea of kind of punching into work at 8:30 a.m. or whatever it is. And so people just had a very fluid, kind of organic sense of time. And then as the clocks got more accurate, the clocks actually played a really crucial role that is, again, rarely discussed in the kind of the dawn of the industrial age, partially because there were clockmakers who had great expertise in England, who learned how to make these mechanical contraptions to make clocks. And they ended up kind of taking that expertise and, in a sense, kind of scaling it up to build larger things like steam engines and mechanical looms and things like that. But the industrial age, once the kind of factory towns started to appear, they required a temporal organization to the world that had to be basically forcibly imposed on people. And so you had to create this idea of shifts of labor that were kind of working on a very clear, you work for 10 hours and then you're done, this new shift comes in. And the idea of punching a clock is introduced for the first time in the 1700s. And so there's a kind of an organization of the day that requires very accurate timekeeping and was in many ways it was felt as a very oppressive force. There's a lot of writing of that period of kind of I think Dickens has a line about kind of the deadly statistical clock or something like that, and Wordsworth rebels against it in the Prelude and things like that. So it was both a kind of a liberating force and an oppressive force in many ways, but the clock was central to that, maybe as important in some ways to industrialization as the steam engine was.
So for a long time, people had pretty accurate clocks that would keep pretty good time. They didn't necessarily line up with what time it was, 50 miles down the road.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and again, this is another story where we don't even think of this as an innovation, but this was something that somebody had to figure out. So until in the United States, until around 1880, every single town was on its own time zone, in the sense that each town would do a local reading of the sun, and the point at which the sun was highest in the sky, that would be noon, and they would set the clocks accordingly. But that meant as you moved from east to west, town by town, you would be kind of 2 minutes behind the last town, and or 7 minutes behind the last town, or 6 minutes behind the last town, depending on how far you had to travel. And again, this is like the spectacles with Gutenberg. This is a problem that no one even noticed, as it wasn't even a problem. It was there, but no one perceived it because you simply didn't have to coordinate with people in other towns with that level of precision. You never had to schedule a conference call or something like that, yeah. Right? And what changed all of this was the railroads. The railroads showed up, and just like the printing press exposed the problem of people's vision, the railroad exposed this problem of the lack of coordination between the towns and their time systems. Because you would get on a train in New York at 12 noon, and you would travel an hour and a half to New Haven. And your watch would say that it was 1:30, but on New Haven time, well, actually, it's 1:42, except that the train you're meeting there is actually on Boston time. And so according to that train, it's 1:57. And you're headed off, to wherever, and there the time is like 2:06. And so it was just suddenly impossible to tell what time it was anymore. And so we had to create this idea of standardized time and standardized time zones in a country as large as the United States. And this had been solved effectively in Canada and the UK before it finally came to the US. But there was a railway clerk named William Allen, who was the big evangelist for this standardized time system. And the hilarious thing about it is there are all these kind of angry letters to the editor of local papers saying, "We shall never bring this unnatural time to Cincinnati. The time should be set by the sun and the sky." And but eventually, you know, people came around to it. And now we just assume that we know what central time is and what mountain time is and what it means to be 8 o'clock.
You do wonder about the lines of demarcation, you know, and how they were selected. So in other words, the boundaries of the time zones, how were those chosen?
Well, today, you know, the time zones are I believe, almost entirely, if not entirely, set by the boundaries of the states. Maybe there are exceptions to that. But in Allen's plan, and this was the case for the first 30 or 40 years of time zones in the U.S., they were set by the kind of terminus points for the rail lines. And so they actually were kind of indifferent to the state boundaries. It was, you know, you would kind of cut off where one main rail line ended. That would be the end of the time zone. And you'd switch forward an hour after that endpoint. And so you can see right there how dependent our sense of time was on this new technology of rail travel. And the other thing about it, this is a great example of unintended consequences, right? So railways change our needs for how we keep time. And so we introduced this innovation of standardized time zones to solve the problem of basically rail travel. But in solving that problem, we created a new kind of solution that became essential 40 or 50 years later when national live media came along, when radio and then television came along. Suddenly it became possible to say, hey, tune into my program at 9 p.m. Central on Wednesday, which is, by the way, when you should tune into my program.
Nicely done.
Thank you. And it became possible to say that and to coordinate everybody's kind of viewing or listening habits because we had these standardized time. Now, Allen wasn't thinking at all about radio or television. That wasn't on his, you know, kind of radar at all in 1875. But it ended up being this platform that became very essential and really, you know, kind of crucial to 20th century media.
My guest is author Stephen Johnson. His newest book is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. The companion television series has been airing on KERA-TV on Wednesday evenings at 9 o'clock. We'll come back to our conversation with Stephen in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Stephen Johnson about his new book, How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. The companion TV series on PBS is viewable on KERA television Wednesday nights at 9 o'clock. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Tammy in Grand Prairie wants to know, Stephen, what you learned from your own parents that cultivated your creativity.
Well, that's a good question. I guess they were very tolerant of the amount of time that I spent locked in my room doing. I was kind of like one of those kids that had a series of obsessions. I kind of mentioned the dice baseball ones, but then I was into magic, and then I was into, oh, God, I was into golf course architecture, bizarrely. And I really like to, like, sit in my room and do these things. And, you know, they would kind of be like, Stephen, don't you want to go outside and play ball? And I'd be like, no, I'd rather sit here with my 20-sided dice and, like, design these new charts for my game. And actually, I found – a couple of years ago, I tracked down on eBay all these original, like, dice games that I used to to play when I was like 9 or 10, and I bought them and brought them home and showed them to my wife, and I was like, look, this is what I did when I was 9, and it was literally like sheets and sheets of numbers. It was not discernibly a game in any way. It was like this incredibly elaborate, you know, it was kind of what you could do before computers. You couldn't actually do this on a home computer, so you had to do it with sheets and sheets of paper with like lookup charts. And I showed it to my wife, and my wife was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea you were such a nerd. So, you know, I think my parents just kind of let me go off on those crazy tangents without getting too kind of baffled by them.
You and I have talked about this before on the show when your book, The Ghost Map, came out. But I think there's just so much to be learned by looking at the history of public sanitation, something we completely take for granted in this country. And I think the Ebola situation in West Africa has been a great reminder of how fortunate we are to have clean running water virtually everywhere you might go in North America.
Yeah, and actually in the series, there's a kind of a 10-minute segment where we tell the story from the ghost map about the cholera epidemic in London in 1854. I allude to it in the book, but I didn't feel it was necessary to rewrite that since I wrote a whole book on that topic. But actually we went. It was funny as an example of how amazing our water is. In the show, we went to a water park in Texas, kind of near Austin, that was just an example of the extremes now that we've gone in terms of frolicking in water that would have been, you know, 120 years ago, that the idea of a water park would have just been – it would have been a total public health hazard. And now people go there, you know, in by the millions to have fun. So that the kind of the celebrating of the heroes and the brilliant minds behind all the systems that bring us clean drinking water, that was a big kind of driving kind of force for the show and for this book, because, you know, we have a whole culture that likes to celebrate innovation, but it's always focused on, you know, the technology titans and the 25-year-old who just sold his company to Facebook for $1 billion and all the gadgets and all that stuff. And I love all that stuff. I spent a lot of time in the tech sector and that world, and I find it very exciting too. But the people who made it possible for us to drink a glass of water from a tap and not die of cholera 3 days later, like that's an extraordinary set of innovations. And it's just – it hums along in the background. We don't ever think about it. So we tried to spend a lot of time kind of unwinding that story, and I hope that people are inspired by it.
Initially, the stories of people not – even when water was available, not wanting to bathe regularly sound sort of yeah. quaint and weird. But they had some pretty reasonable justifications for initially not believing that it was a good idea to constantly immerse yourself in water.
Well, the water just – first off, it was hard to get access to it, right? So you didn't – you know, we had to develop systems that would just deliver piped-in water to our homes, which really wasn't customary, you know, in a – you know, even in an advanced city like London, you know, until the, you know, 1800s. But then the water supply wasn't clean, and it was being intermixed with the waste of a city, in the case of London, of, you know, a million or 2 million people. And so it was a huge transmission vehicle for disease. But there is this funny thing where, like, for a long period of time, people believed that that if you allowed a certain kind of layer of dirt to clog up your pores,
protective,
that was protective, and it kept, you know, whatever noxious agents were floating around in the air from like crawling into your skin. And so they were like, don't bathe, whatever you do, don't submerge yourself in water. That will be the worst thing you could possibly do. So the whole convention of, you know, taking a shower or taking a bath, you know, it had to be invented on some level. Both the technology that brought the shower into your home, which involved a lot of different things, but also just it had to be invented culturally. Like, people had to kind of spread the word that taking a bath or a shower every now and then was actually a good idea. And you can see this most clearly in the there's all this interesting stuff in the book about kind of the royalty
yeah.
from the 1600s, 1700s. Where they, you know, these people had access. They had a million servants who would draw them a bath you know, the second they commanded it. They had no need to they had no problem getting into water to bathe, but they would go, you know, months and months and months without taking a bath because they thought it was not healthy.
It's weird to think of the people in all those ornate clothes and the ways that they have reeked after a very short time.
It really, it's I like that because we think of, you know, we tend to think of history and we go to see these palaces as our kind of vision of what history is like. And even, you know, and we rarely go to, I mean, in New York here, there's a wonderful tenement museum where you can get a sense of what it was like to live in a tenement in 1850. But most of the museums and the kind of representations of the past are very grand. And to think that even inside, you know, Versailles, there were people who had deliberately chosen not to bathe for half a year is kind of appalling.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Doug in Dallas. Hi, Doug.
Hey, Stephen. Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure.
Stephen, I loved the show about time and was particularly fascinated with the segment on Aaron Dennison. And you talked about kind of tech innovation a second ago. It was just the coolest old school example of a guy I'd never heard of and how he just observed life, applied it to a different realm, and then made these incredible improvements, like he did with his dad's, cobbler store, and then the pocket watch later. Could you just speak a little bit more about Aaron Dennison? It was fascinating to me.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thank you. I'm so glad you enjoyed that. It's funny. He was known as the lunatic of Boston, which I think is particularly funny because there actually are multiple characters who show up in the book and the show who were known as the lunatic of Boston. So somehow Boston seems to have this ability to produce very interesting people, but also to appall the kind of mainstream society in Boston, which is, I don't know why that is. Anyway, he hit upon this way basically of kind of mass producing watches, and up until that point, there were pocket watches that were quite accurate in terms of their timing, but they were very expensive. And so actually in the kind of the literature of the period leading up to this kind of 18th century, 19th century literature, one of the ways in which a novelist would signal that, you know, his character or her character got very fancy is that they would acquire a watch. You know, it's like, ooh, you know, it's like it would literally be the equivalent now of being like, and then he bought a Ferrari, you know, like that. It's like, he got a watch? Wow, that's amazing. And so Dennison figured out this way of basically democratizing time and kind of borrowing techniques that were being used for manufacturing, you know, guns and kind of interchangeable parts, standardizing parts and things like that. He built this watch that was basically 10 times cheaper than the competition, and it became a big hit. And what I think is so interesting about it is that in a way the watch, the Ellery watch as it was called, that Dennison came up with was kind of the first, you know, kind of must-have consumer technology gadget. It not only changed our relationship to time, but it set a kind of a template that then would be filled by, you know, the Sony Walkman or the iPod or something like that 100 years later, 150 years later. So it's a really interesting story. Now, of course, we take it for granted that we walk around with watches. And it'll be interesting. I mean, now we've got this Apple Watch that's coming, so maybe there'll be a new wave of innovation with watches.
The chapter on sound is fascinating. The idea of the power of amplified sound is really interesting, and it turns out to be sort of chilling in the conclusions that you draw.
Well, you know, I tried, and I think that honestly the book does this a little bit better than the show. I tried to not just have it be a book entirely of kind of boosterism about every innovation that's ever happened. It's a very upbeat book, and I tend to be, you know, kind of optimistic about the world. So, but I did try to kind of point out that, particularly in terms of these unintended consequences, that some things just aren't great. And one of the examples is amplification. Once you had the ability, thanks largely to the vacuum tube, to take one person's voice and make it loud enough so that 100,000 people could hear it, it did a lot of things. But one of the things it enabled to do was to create the format of a kind of a mass rally. And you think of the iconic images of kind of 20th century politics that were made possible. You know, yes, the I Have a Dream speech, you know, just wouldn't have been possible without the amplification of the vacuum tube, but also the Nuremberg rallies. I mean, such a central component of what 20th century fascism looked like. The ability that you'd have a crowd of 100 or 200,000 people listening to one kind of supreme leader speaking to them, that just wasn't possible. You could have big mass rallies, but they couldn't be oriented around the sound of a single person before amplification came along. And it's not that the vacuum tube, you know, made fascism, right. Obviously, but it is an important part of that story and the kind of iconography of that, you know, hideous chapter in politics. And again, like air conditioning, it's not often discussed in that history.
Even the fact that it was novel must have carried a particular weight, right? No one had seen this before, and so it must have felt like something special.
Yeah, when you have the kind of the weight of new communication forms behind you, as you're introducing a new vision of the world, people get kind of caught up in that.
Let's jump back on the phones now. We have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. First of all, I want to say I love Stephen's show, and Chris, I love your show. I think you're one of the best interviewers on the air.
Thank you.
But my question is, Stephen, were you inspired by any other books or shows? The one I'm thinking of is I used to watch a show when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s on the BBC called Connections and the Day the Universe Changed by James Burke, and they touch on a lot of the subjects that you do. And I love that show, and I love your show.
Oh, thank you. And I second the comment about Chris's show, too. It's funny. I didn't watch – Burke's show was on PBS when I was growing up apparently, but I didn't watch it as a kid because I was locked in my room playing baseball games, as you all know now. But after my second book, Emergence, which I probably talked about on the show a million years ago, I had a bunch of people come up to me and say, hey, you know, your book reminds me of this show and these books by this guy James Burke. And so I went back and checked those out and – you know, they're wonderful programs. And so it was very much – and our show is actually a joint production with the BBC. So I think there was, you know, there was a sense that we were following in his footsteps for sure. I mean, the funny thing about it is I think this way of doing history, of telling history is – it's so important. It seems odd to me that when you see the show on television, particularly that – To come up with an analogy, to come up with another show that's approaching history this way, we have to kind of take our minds back to Connections, which was originally produced in 1978.
Wow.
And there's more book writing in this mode. I mean, there are a lot of books that take, you know, books like Cod and Salt and things like that that take one thing and look at its impact. So it's in the actual, you know, kind of world of history books, I think this approach is a bit more common. But it hasn't been as much on television, and I think that's just kind of odd. So I feel like there could be 10 programs on the air right now that would kind of explore our history from this angle, and there'd still be plenty of stories to go around.
Is this your new pattern, do you think? You'll write books and then make a companion series?
I don't think I'll do it forever, but this sure has been fun, and I think there's a lot of interest in doing another season or two. So hopefully we will do that because it's been a great – I mean, talk about collaborative kind of networks. This doing this with a great team that we work with has been really rewarding.
The new book by author Stephen Johnson is called How We Got to Now, Six Innovations That Made the Modern World. The companion TV series on PBS airs on KERA Channel 13 television Wednesday nights at 9. Stephen, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me back.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.